Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the message of Martin Luther King Jr. as local leaders mark the King holiday.
We are shaking the table in the corridors of power at the policy and decision-making tables.
Also, we talk with the spouse of a Coast Guard member who's working without pay because of the government shutdown.
They are the wall. They're the ones who are stopping the people from coming across the waterways and into the ports. Reopen the government and then negotiate on border security.
Plus, the Patriots off to the Super Bowl again.
We're going for six rings! Six rings, baby! Six rings! We are going to the Super Bowl, baby!
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Today's annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast in Boston highlighted some recent electoral changes and what they might suggest about King's vision for a more equitable society. Freshman Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley thanked Dr. King and his wife, Coretta Scott King, for their influence on the civil rights movement.
We are shaking the table in the corridors of power at the policy and decision-making tables, assuming our rightful place as the preservers of democracy, as the truth tellers and the justice seekers. So yes, thank you, Martin. And thank you, Coretta.
Joining us to talk more about this is WBUR reporter Callum Borchers, who was at the breakfast. Hi there, Cal.
Hey there, Deb.
So Boston Police Commissioner William Gross was also among those who spoke today, and he emphasized this theme of change in political representation since King's Day. Let's listen to a bit of what Commissioner Gross said.
Look at the face of politics in Boston, where you have six women of color on Boston City Council. Look at the face of politics, both state and locally.
So, Callum, what else did we hear from the commissioner and others today?
Well, you know, he did talk a little bit about himself, Deb. He is, after all, the first black police commissioner in Boston. He's the 42nd commissioner overall, so we quipped that he shares that number with another pioneer. That would be Jackie Robinson, of course. But really, he talked a lot about voting. You know, he sort of emphasized that the reason you're seeing these changes, the half dozen women of color on the Boston City Council, Ayanna Pressley in Congress, even him in the more indirect way as the commissioner of Boston, is because people are speaking and they're turning out to vote.
So let's hear a little bit more of what Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley said. She also thanked her mother, Sandy Pressley, today.
It's black women like Sandy Pressley and Coretta Scott King that nursed babies, that oiled scalps, that moisturized elbows and knees, that cooked, that fed, that prayed, that led, that were architects of movements all the way on today to Black Lives Matter. Black women, we are reclaiming our time.
So really what Pressley was getting at there was kind of putting her win in November in the context of decades and even longer of, in her view, black women being relegated to supporting roles. This is why I think she wanted to pay special tribute to Coretta Scott King. She was there saying, look, yes, here we're at the MLK breakfast. We're here to honor him. But he wouldn't have accomplished what he did without her by his side. And now here I am as the first black woman from Massachusetts in Congress.
Hmm. You know, Senators Markey and Elizabeth Warren were also in attendance today, both commenting on the government shutdown. Let's listen to a little bit of Senator Markey.
Even at 90 years old, you just know Dr. King would have been standing alongside the unpaid federal government workers just as he stood with the sanitation workers in Memphis the night before he died.
So, Callum, how much was the current political situation mentioned during the breakfast today, would you say?
You know, it really depended on the speaker. So Presley made a deliberate effort to not talk about the president. Mm. In fact, one of her first remarks when she got up was basically to say, you know, the oppressor, as she referred to him, without naming him, gets enough oxygen, enough attention, so let's not give him any more. But Markey and Elizabeth Warren went after him hard. Of course, Warren is running for president, or at least exploring that possibility, mm-hmm. very much in campaign mode, however. And we really saw some of that today. This was a little bit of what Elizabeth Warren said today that sort of fit into the stump speech that we've heard already from her in Iowa, New Hampshire, and elsewhere.
Race matters. Call it out and fight back. The path to economic security is steep and rocky for millions of working people in America, and it is steeper and rockier for Black and Brown Americans.
And so what Warren really added there was to say, if we want to carry on Dr. King's legacy, it's our job to call out that type of imbalance. Hmm.
Now, we heard today that the Boston Foundation and Boston University have joined together and they're going to donate $750,000 for efforts to memorialize Dr. King and his wife here in Boston. What do you know about that?
Right. So those are the latest additions to what is a $12 million effort to build a memorial to the Kings, both of them, on Boston Common. And we got an update from Paul English, the Kayak founder who is helping to organize that today. Said they're about halfway to meeting that goal, so that was big news. And, of course, the Kings have a rich history in Boston. Dr. King studied theology here at Boston University, just up the street. He met Coretta Scott here in Boston. And as Paul English noted in his remarks at the breakfast this morning, there's a local filmmaker working on a documentary about that love story, how the two of them met right here in Boston.
All right. WBUR Bostonomics reporter Callum Borchers, thanks so much for being with us.
Glad to be with you.
And while each year we reflect on King's legacy in the United States, Dr. King also had a substantial international impact. While he was provoking some intense animosity in the U.S., our next guest says Dr. King was sometimes treated like a celebrity overseas. Jason Sokol is professor of history at the University of New Hampshire and author of the book titled The Heavens Might Crack: The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. And he joined us to talk about the inverse relationship between King's global popularity and his perception at home.
By the end of King's life, 1967 and 1968, many white Americans had sort of turned against him. And that was because King had grown increasingly radical. Namely, he had delivered this famous address critiquing the Vietnam War. That was in Riverside Church in New York City in 1967. And King really critiqued all of American society in that address. And in turn, many Americans from President Johnson on down began to think of King as more of a rabble-rouser and an agitator. The interesting thing is that abroad, King's comments about Vietnam were the kind of thing that many people overseas embraced. I mean, many people from Europe to Africa and Asia viewed the U.S.'s waging of the Vietnam War as basically a brutal imperialist folly. And here was King calling it that.
Right, right. We actually have a clip from that speech in 1967 in New York. Let's listen.
It is curious that the Americans who calculate so carefully on the possibilities of military victory do not realize that in the process they're incurring deep psychological and political defeat. The image of America will never again be the image of revolution, freedom, and democracy, but the image of violence and militarism, unquote. If we continue, there will be no doubt in my mind and in the mind of the world that we have no honorable intentions in Vietnam.
That was the speech that really rose his profile internationally, right?
Right. I mean, he's talking about what the image of America was overseas. And, for instance, you know, these people abroad, when King critiqued U.S. policy, they really felt that he was speaking for them. As you say, you know, this is the kind of thing that turned many Americans against him. I mean, even sort of mainstream white liberals who had been supportive of King during his crusades in the South and Birmingham and Selma. Well, now he was deploring the U.S. as a whole, and he was also moving more radical more radically on what he was saying about income inequality.
Mm. You know, even before that speech, you write in your book about a visit, King's visit to Germany in September of 1964, and how he was treated there, you say, like an international rock star. What happened there?
This visit to Berlin in 1964, part of what was fascinating is that people in West Berlin and in East Berlin both greeted King like a champion. King arrived in West Germany. He gave an address in an open-air stadium to thousands of Germans, and he was basically talking about the civil rights movement and about struggles for freedom in the West. And then he crossed over into the East that night, and he was also greeted like a like an international champion there as well.
And he was allowed in.
He was allowed in. There's a funny story where he got to Checkpoint Charlie and he had, in fact, forgot his passport. They asked for any kind of an identification. He showed his American Express card and they let him through. But, you know, the guards didn't let him through just on their own accord. The East German government had indeed decided that it would be beneficial for King to come to East Berlin. And that was because East German leaders, like many communist leaders, were interested in anything that would show America in a bad light. So King was there to highlight, you know, the great blot on the United States, and that blot was the continuation of racial injustice and racial inequality.
But of course, the reason he's drawing these crowds is they're inspired by his message of rebellion.
Right. So thousands of people packed into this church in East Berlin to hear King speak because his address about freedom and the black freedom struggle, and he ended it on the refrain of "Let my people go." That kind of address really resonated with the ordinary East Berliners who saw themselves being oppressed and repressed by that regime.
Now, shortly after that, he wins the Nobel Peace Prize. And we have a clip of his acceptance speech that I want to play. And in this clip, King is questioning why the prize was given to someone who's leading a movement that hasn't won peace. Let's listen.
Civilization and violence are antithetical concepts. Negroes of the United States, following the people of India, have demonstrated that nonviolence is not sterile passivity, but a powerful moral force which makes for social transformation. Sooner or later, all the peoples of the world will have to discover a way to live together in peace and thereby transform this pending cosmic elegy into a creative psalm of brotherhood.
What would you say, if you could sum it up, because I'm sure it's complicated, but what was the effect of winning the Nobel Peace Prize, both domestically and internationally, for King?
Yeah, well, I think it was really important to him to understand that he had allies all around the world. So often throughout his career, if King would feel the vitriol in the U.S. really boiling, he sometimes took trips abroad because he learned that he could breathe there, you know, mm-hmm. that he wasn't he wasn't sort of hunted down each day and each moment. He wasn't a target of white segregationists. He wasn't a target of the FBI. So when he went abroad, he did find something of a safe haven.
Right. And you write in the book about how, you know, he goes to accept the Nobel Prize, and it's this great celebration. And then he comes back, and folks in Atlanta have to, you know, be almost forced to attend a dinner for him and do it begrudgingly so they don't look bad, really. So can you explain that a little bit?
That's right. He was given the Nobel Peace Prize, and so a few leading white liberals in Atlanta, Ralph McGill, who was the publisher of the Atlanta Constitution, and a couple of religious leaders, decided that they wanted his hometown of Atlanta to honor King with a banquet. And they sent out telegrams asking for donations and support, and very few of Atlanta's leading white businessmen were interested in helping out. They saw King basically as an agitator and somebody who was stirring up trouble. And so you had this this great dissonance, that this person who's just been recognized with one of the greatest global awards, and then in his hometown, it took every bit of cajoling to finally get a banquet for him. And indeed, the banquet only took place after New York Times and NBC News wrote and aired these spots publicizing the fact that white Atlanta was not interested in honoring King. Well, finally, those leading businessmen in Atlanta were basically shamed into supporting that kind of banquet, and indeed it finally happened, but only after great toil.
Do you think that part of the difference between the way King was received in the U.S. and internationally is because you could admire him and his courage from afar, because really it's not threatening your way of life at all or anything that's happening to you personally? I mean, is that part of it?
That's got to be part of it, yeah. I mean, when King was talking about revolutionizing a society or transforming a nation, he was usually talking about transforming the United States.
Right.
So those kinds of words and actions of his were indeed most threatening to whites in the United States, whereas often people around the world could cheer on King basically from the sidelines, mm-hmm. and rest assured that he wasn't attempting to overturn their society. Although there were a few exceptions to that. I mean, for instance, the South African government didn't allow King to speak in South Africa because they were worried about the effect that he might have on people there. So I think he did actually have a tangible effect in some places, even though that general dynamic is definitely true.
Can he be compared with Nelson Mandela or Gandhi? I mean, what do you say when folks make those comparisons?
I'd say, oh, of course. I mean, this was one of the things that I really learned through doing the research and the writing of this book. I mean, I, like most Americans, had initially viewed King as basically an American leader and a civil rights leader, and I hadn't appreciated his global reach and the fact that he was seen as a hero by so many people across the globe, people who were waging struggles, anti-racist struggles or anti-imperialist struggles, many places, the countries of Africa. For instance, in India, he was hailed as indeed the heir to Gandhi. So you mentioned Gandhi, and mm-hmm. people in India saw that connection very clearly and found it very powerful and profound.
But of course, now what we're seeing internationally is a lot of nationalism. And, if you're saying the international community was much more accepting of a Dr. King than the United States.
Yeah.
I don't know that would be the case right now based on what we're hearing about what's happening internationally. Well, why do you think that is?
Yeah, probably not. I mean, King himself argued that national boundaries were somewhat artificial. I mean, he would have argued for lifting borders and certainly not building walls. He is a symbol and a powerful symbol to people fighting for freedom everywhere, I would say.
All right. Jason Sokol, professor of history at the University of New Hampshire and author of the book The Heavens Might Crack, The Death and Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. Jason, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
And to talk more about Dr. King's influence around the globe and here at home, we're joined by Khalil Muhammad from WBGO in Newark, New Jersey. He's a professor of history, race, and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So how would you describe Martin Luther King Jr.'s international impact?
Well, I'd say that we have to think about the context of the Cold War and anti-colonial struggles, which are happening simultaneously to the civil rights movement. And in that sense, there is a tremendous community of transnational connections of people who self-identified, including in King's own language, as colored people of the world. The potential for what this broad international community of oftentimes majorities, populations in colonial nations in Africa, Asia, and Latin America were beginning to throw off what they would call the yoke of imperialism. They met in Indonesia in 1955, And so Dr. King's increasing influence as a result of early successes in the civil rights movement vis-a-vis Montgomery in 1955 through 1956 sent powerful signals around the world to other communities, other nations fighting against Western dominance that they could win.
You know, we just heard from Professor Jason Sokol, and he wrote about how Dr. King inspired social movements all over the globe. But, you know, considering the nationalism that we're seeing in so many countries now, especially here, how do we reconcile this situation with what it was like when King was so well regarded? How do you explain that?
Well, it's a great question. Well, one way to think about it is to think about time. So Dr. King dies in 1968, which is in some ways precisely the moment of a kind of global precipice of often student-led social movements that upended many liberal democracies, certainly created moments of crises. And of course, we know them very well here in the United States around the election of Richard Nixon and the great moment of the whole world is watching in Chicago. That was just one node of a larger global struggle that was playing out in Mexico City and Paris and many other places. So when Dr. King is literally on the eve of his death, when he writes in his final book, Where Do We Go From Here, he's writing about a backlash that he sees with regard to the real struggle of redressing the historical divestment of these communities of color, these black people in the United States, these colored people elsewhere, and that it would, in his own words, cost billions of rich nations. And so that kind of anticipation of a backlash to something more than just the promise of legal equality is in some ways the crisis of the resurgent white nationalist and alt-right movements that we see across liberal democracies in Western and in some cases younger democracies in Eastern Europe, that the very notion that people from other parts of the world, from Asia, from Africa, from the Middle East, are moving into these countries that claim to believe in a kind of liberal democracy where there are flows of labor that are the promises of citizenship have been roundly rejected because the resources would have to be redistributed in order to ensure a decent quality of life for these people.
Is that similar thinking when we talk about folks who are rising to positions of leadership? We talked about this morning's breakfast in Boston for Dr. King, where newly elected political leaders like Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley spoke about this changing face of political leadership. But you know, you've written about this before. How, in terms of how it pertains to President Obama, and you said, quote, no individual can bend the moral arc of our universe. What did you mean by that?
Well, I meant that we have mythologized Dr. King's influence. I know that you and many others have been to Dr. King celebrations, and the keynote of often of these celebrations is any one of you can make a difference, just like Dr. King could. But Dr. King was very clear in so much of his writing that it wasn't about what an individual could do. In fact, it was about what people would have to do together, and that the work of transformation was also the work of the state. So we have lost the actual king in exchange for a kind of mythology that gives us little more than just the representation of aspiration, of a dream, of the desire, or symbolic representation, as in the first black this or the first brown that or the first woman that. But Dr. King was clear. Systems had to be changed. He believed in fundamental transformation of our society.
And biggest system that you think would need to be changed before we would notice a more tangible effect here?
Oh, absolutely. We have to fundamentally change our economic system that is grinding and chewing up people not only here in the United States, regardless of their background, but also around the globe. So we know, I mean, this is not a question. We know that the global elite are absorbing resources from the productive capacity of people all over the world, which is unsustainable. And Dr. King was trying to call attention to that, as we well know, through his Poor People's March, but through a fundamental critique of the fact that we have created money as the governing ethos of how to organize society rather than personhood. So we have to focus on caring about human beings, or what King would say, of people over profit.
What do you think Dr. King would urge this Congress, the most diverse Congress ever, what would he urge this Congress to try to accomplish?
Well, I think that he would stand, at least at this point, on the side of those who are resisting walls, those on the side who recognize refugees. He was a Christian minister. He recognized in the parables of the Gospels, as well as in the life of Jesus Christ, that there are, in fact, the least of these in our society that deserve the most of our attention. And so for that, Dr. King, he would stand for those, whether they were big D Democrats, as in the party, or small D Democrats in the sense of those as human beings deserve a voice and a role in our society, and that nations and borders are not the way to define what human beings deserve.
You know, there was a controversial column in the Boston Globe over the weekend. The headline was, "As MLK Foresaw, Racism in America Has Been Largely Overcome." And in this column by Jeff Jacoby, the argument is that there are a bunch of statistics here that show that racism is less entrenched than it was in Dr. King's day. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I saw the column, and his evidence were all self-reported attitudes about intimacy and relationships, marriage, sending your kid to school with someone, living in the same neighborhood. It is the oldest and in some ways the most discredited benchmark for the problem of racism in America. Dr. King didn't talk as much about holding hands, black children and white children, so much as he talked about police brutality, so much as he talked about the franchise, so much as he talked about people being able to sit at a lunch counter but not be able to afford to eat there. So this is a complete distortion of the measure of racism in American society. Is that to say that these are not healthy signs of some measure of progress? Absolutely not. But to suggest that we can't claim racism as a problem in our society because of self-reported white attitudes about the potential of interracial marriage for their children is a distortion of the actual work that Dr. King left unfinished.
What do you think is a way that we might be able to measure whether the U.S. is making any progress?
Well, we would look at the same racial disparities that we see in terms of educational outcomes, in terms of who's likely to be punished for various crimes, including extreme sentences for violence, which were a product of deciding that black people in particular didn't deserve second chances. In other words, we would read the vast litany of racial disparities that most of us know pretty well. We are inundated with them, not as evidence of some kind of inherent inferiority of black people or of Mexican people, or that poor people in general are somehow broken at birth, or, as I often hear, have the unfortunate misfortune of growing up in a bad zip code, but in fact that we would see these as evidence of layers of disadvantage that are a function of actual policy and our politics. If we've learned nothing else in the age of the Trump administration, is that policy matters. The very fight over this new Congress and people like Ayanna Pressley is a fight over policy. And so we got into the situation where we see racial disparities all around us because of political choices and policy decisions. And so Dr. King, as he said in his own lifetime, would call our attention to the work of redressing those.
You know, you wrote a piece in 2017 that was published in the New York Times about racial barriers, and you quoted part of Martin Luther King's last book in 1967, where King warned that the civil rights movement was, quote, hobbled by delusion. He said the majority of white Americans consider themselves committed to racial justice, but unfortunately, this is a fantasy of self-deception. What do you think he meant by that, and why did you quote it in your piece in the New York Times in 2017?
Well, because Dr. King learned late in his life, as it turns out, that when he shifted from the legislative successes of the civil rights movement to taking on the entrenched problem of poverty and racism and institutional racism in northern cities, he got a lot more depressed about what he was seeing. He was seeing a kind of entrenched white privilege and resistance to any fundamental change in the condition of black life that would not be solved by the kinds of laws that the civil rights movement had just taken credit for. And in that sense, he recognized that unless white people let go of their own sense of superiority or supremacy over African Americans or others in this country and around the world, that we would continue to see that people's lives would be unimportant to the nation's future, that his most aspirational notion of a beloved community would never be realized. And so he said, we have to face the facts of racism squarely and scientifically so that we don't continue to delude ourselves about what the problem actually is in America.
Hmm. So what would you say has changed racially since then?
Yeah. Well, I would say that we've become a lot more prickly about being called racist.
That's for sure.
Certainly.
Yeah,
that's
okay.
That's certainly true. Yeah. I would say that we can think of this as we've seen a lot of barriers fall, which is the, kind of the point of that piece. We've seen a lot of barriers fall, and of course, the White House being the most coveted of them all. And so we have to take stock of that. Yes, we have a new black police chief in Boston, first time in history. That's something to celebrate. And therefore, we can talk about the numbers of African Americans have moved into levels of middle and senior management. Although the numbers are fairly stagnant, they still represent significant change from 50 years ago when Dr. King was still around. So almost in every aspect of American society and life, we can see some measure of progress in terms of the numbers of black people who are in those positions and to some degree the way that the economic pie has been distributed, particularly among affluent Americans, because the truth is, and here I'll shift ground, that poverty has grown for poor people and wages have stagnated for poor people no matter what color you are, or what background you have. And that problem is most acutely felt for African Americans because they carry the weight of their historical disadvantage and new forms of disadvantage. Mm. So it is not just a mixed story. It is an unbalanced story, meaning that there has been progress for a smaller number at the top and retrogression. We have receded for a big number at the bottom. The last example, and I won't belabor the point, is the criminal justice system was nothing like it was in 1968 as it is in 2018. It is a behemoth. It is the most largest system of unfreedom that the world has ever known in terms of a criminal justice system, and black people have borne the brunt of that in ways that we are still discovering.
All right. Khalil Muhammad, professor of history, race, and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School, thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The now 31-day-long partial government shutdown was repeatedly mentioned at today's Martin Luther King Jr. events and elsewhere. At Logan Airport today, Senator Elizabeth Warren spoke at a union rally.
We are here to send a very simple message to Washington. Open our government and pay our people for the work they do.
Among those working and not being paid are the more than 40,000 members of the U.S. Coast Guard. Earlier today, we spoke with Amy Chittum, who lives in Maine and whose husband is among those unpaid workers.
It's been pretty intense, actually. My husband's paycheck covers about two-thirds of our income at this point in our life. He is been with the Coast Guard for 7 years now, and he, you know, he works more than 40 hours a week, depending on what their operations are. If he's out to sea, you know, it's sometimes for a week or 2 weeks, or if he's just in the office, it's just for the day. So having him not get paid and still working full time has just, it hasn't completely devastated us because I do have a job, but has definitely changed the way we're living.
And how so? What do you have to do to accommodate?
So we've had him sleeping at the station or on the boat when he, you know, in between shifts. We live in Maine, but he's stationed in Sector Boston because our son has autism, and he is enrolled in a special school district here in Maine. And when we were stationed in Boston a year ago, we knew it would be a temporary assignment, and we didn't want to pull our son away from those services just to be moved again. So he does the commute between Maine and Boston about four times a week. So as you can imagine, it's about $40 a day for him to come back and forth between the city. So he's been staying down there as much as possible. And then also we've had to change our diet. My son is a very special diet because of the autism. He has a lot of food aversions or things he just won't touch. And we're relying on food banks right now to supplement our income because we can't afford our regular grocery list. And so that's been very challenging for me to try to come up with creative things that my son will eat, and that's okay for him. And then finally, because we are being restationed in a few months, our house needs to go up for sale. And we are in the middle of prepping it for sale, and we had to stop all of our renovations. We can't afford them right now, just cold turkey, just stopped in the middle of a kitchen reno, which is very stressful to have a kitchen halfway finished and not be able to do anything. And then my husband's leaving in 7 days for 4 months. So that means it's on me to do it alone, you know, if and when we start getting paid again.
Over the weekend, there was a tweet from the Coast Guard of audio of a boat captain who got on his radio near Alabama. And I want to play a little bit of that for you right now. Let's listen.
My name's Joseph, and I'm the captain of a shrimp vessel. And I'd just like to say thank you. Thank you to the Coast Guard who's working and ain't receiving pay. I'm sure I speak for all of us. It's nice to know that we're out here at night and we can still depend on you. Thank you, Coast Guard.
Amy, is that any consolation? How does that make you feel?
The first time I heard that when it was played over the weekend, I actually burst out into tears because it is this, I know why they do what they do. Like, I'm proud of my husband every single day for what he does. He's saved lives before. He's, you know, stopped drug trafficking. He's stopped illegal immigrants. Like, he's done amazing things in his life that I can't even begin to understand. And he's not sorry that we're Coast Guard. I'm not sorry that we're Coast Guard. And I think that it's a great thing to be part of. So it's these guys need us. The men and the women that do fishing and do commerce in the waterways, they need the Coast Guard. And so they're not going to give up on them just because they're not being paid.
So you don't have any, you don't think your husband has any second thoughts about being in the Coast Guard and dealing with this because of this shutdown and what it's done to your paycheck?
Absolutely not. We love being Coast Guard. It's we live, breathe, eat, sleep Coast Guard. It's what we do. We live in a really wonderful country, and the Coast Guard is one of the best in the world, and it's not well appreciated. We get made fun of by all the other military branches, and most Americans don't know what the Coast Guard does. But those that do appreciate us, and I don't think we would give up this lifestyle for anything. This will pass. The government will sort itself out one way or another, and we'll all get through this and say, well, we lived through the shutdown of 2019, and we're still here.
So when you look at it right now, who do you think is to blame mostly for this?
Well, you know, I think there are multiple parties involved, to be honest. I think that holding people financially hostage is wrong, and I don't care what the reason is for. It's wrong, and it needs to end. So reopen the government and then negotiate on border security. If we really want border security, enlarge the Coast Guard, enlarge border security for the other agents that work. You know, they are the wall. They're the ones who are stopping the people from coming across the waterways and into the ports. It's not a physical barrier. You need these men and women chasing down these little boats full of people that are trying to arrive illegally and are dying on the way. It's the Coast Guard that picks up those bodies, you know? They do a tremendous amount of work. So everybody, all those politicians need to think more about how to better construct security in this country by using the men and women that we already have.
So at what point do you think you would have to make, you know, serious changes? I mean, you've got a 7-year-old son. At what point is it really going to affect the way you are able to live and survive?
Yeah, we've got not much longer, a couple of weeks at most. At least now, like, the mortgage is paid and we are getting donations and food, so we're okay. But 3 weeks from now, when the mortgage is due again, I don't know what's going to happen. It's very scary for us. I don't want to have to put our house up for sale and buy something smaller. We shouldn't have to think about that sort of thing. We have a right to own our home. We have a right to be paid.
All right. Well, Amy Chittum, a professional archaeologist and an office associate in Maine. Her husband, Ethan, is a seaman in the Coast Guard, and he has been working during this government shutdown. Amy, best of luck to you, and thanks so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, the Patriots are headed to their third consecutive Super Bowl. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, it never seems to get old. The Patriots are again heading to the Super Bowl.
Second and goal to Burkhead. Burkhead to the end zone. Hello, Super Bowl. New England is heading back again for the third straight year.
In last night's nail-biting AFC Championship game, the Patriots beat the Kansas City Chiefs 37-31 in overtime. And joining us to talk about that and what we can expect in the Super Bowl is WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer. Hi there.
Hello.
So big moments in that game, huh? What a game.
It was. I mean, back and forth in the fourth quarter, and then you get to overtime, and the Patriots win the coin toss. And I think at that moment, all the Patriots were like, okay, we've got this because we've got Tom Brady. And then, of course, 75-yard drive downfield and Rex Burkhead for a 2-yard game-winning touchdown and another trip to the Super Bowl.
Now, as we said, the game went into overtime, but that's been controversial. So tell us
about
that.
To put it mildly, I mean, if you were on sports Twitter after this game, as I was, people were ripping the NFL and saying that the NFL's rules for overtime are atrocious, terrible, need to be redone. And it's hard to disagree with that when the only team that touched the ball, you know, went on offense in overtime was the Patriots. So you have a up-and-coming quarterback, Patrick Mahomes, who everybody is dying to see what he will do in a pressure situation like this. How creative will he be? What will he sort of pull out of his bag of tricks? And he doesn't even get into the game. And there's something really wrong with that. After it was such a, you know, hard-fought back-and-forth game, to not have both teams' quarterbacks get a chance at posting up a winning score, or, you know, to have that back-and-forth battle continue. I predict, you know, I think we might see this revised because there is such outrage now about the structure of overtime.
Now, you know, there was a lot of talk about Rob Gronkowski. How is he going to perform with all those injuries? But, you know, should people rest easy now after the game, after his performance, or what would you say?
I think we can say Gronk is back, at least back to the player that fans know and love. I mean, he finished last night's game with 6 catches for 79 yards. 2 of those catches came on big third down plays, one late in the fourth quarter and one during the Patriots' game-winning drive in overtime. And more than that, you could just tell by the way he was talking after the game that the enthusiasm is back, that the love for football is back. And it was great to see, because that's the Gronk you want playing for the Patriots. And then, to top it all off, after the game, Tom Brady posted a video on Instagram, and it was Rob Gronkowski and him them walking to the team bus, and they kind of were like smirking, smiling with a little bit of, you know, sort of a mischievous smile, and they weren't saying anything. And then it cut to footage of the game-winning touchdown. That's the Gronkowski we've all come to know and love, the playful, having fun with the game player.
So let's talk a little bit about commentator and former NFL quarterback Tony Romo. Kept predicting the plays. What's going on?
It is amazing. I mean, this guy, he was on the ball, so to speak, a lot of times and just getting into the mind of both the Patriots offense and the Chiefs offense. He was so good that free agent Bryce Harper, he's an outfielder in Major League Baseball, sort of set Twitter ablaze by saying, confirmed, just call Tony Romo, and I know where I'm going to play next year. I mean, that was the power of, he was joking, of course, but that was sort of the perceived power of Tony Romo's predictive abilities. And it was amazing and real insight into what both coaches were thinking. Or should have been thinking in some cases.
Last week, we heard Tom Brady respond to the naysayers who were speculating the end of the Patriots dynasty. And he went with this underdog narrative again after last night's win. Let's listen.
The odds were stacked against us. And it hasn't been that way for us for a while. And it certainly was this year. And, you know, we started off so slow. And like I said, the last four games have been our best games.
So, Shira, Patriots, underdogs.
Yeah, that's a really hard one to sell at this point when you're heading back to your third straight Super Bowl and the ninth Super Bowl in the Belichick-Brady era. But, you know, Brady's really leaning into it. And I think, you know, this is a guy who's sort of been discounted, as we know, picked in the sixth round early in his career and sort of had to prove himself. So he's someone who, I guess, gets really fired up, or actually, I don't guess, you can see, gets really fired up by being discounted and being doubted. That being said, take a look at what the odds makers are saying. The Rams were initially a one-point favor, but the odds quickly swung in favor of the Patriots. Now they're a one-point favorite. I wouldn't be surprised to see the Patriots become a bigger favorite as we get closer to the Super Bowl.
And this matchup with the Rams, too, it's a little bit of deja vu here. The Pats beat the then St. Louis Rams.
Yeah. The greatest show on turf is what they called them. It's a great nickname.
That was in 2002, so tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, this is what started the Patriots dynasty. This was the big Super Bowl win number one for Brady and Belichick. If you recall, it was a last second field goal by Adam Vinatieri, final score 20-17. And I think one of the indelible images from that night was a very, very young looking Tom Brady, just wide eyed and in complete awe of what had happened, because don't forget, he had replaced Drew Bledsoe midway through that season. So this was just kind of the start of his ascension to becoming the greatest of all time.
And now, in 2 weeks from now, what do you think we can expect from the Rams in the Super Bowl?
It's going to be an interesting matchup. You've got sort of this young versus old matchup, right? You've got Belichick, 66, Brady, 41. And then
ancient.
Ancient in football terms in some respects, particularly for Brady. And then on the other side, you've got Sean McVay, who's the coach of the Los Angeles Rams. He is 32. I believe he's turning 33 in a few days. And then you've got Jared Goff, the quarterback, who's 24. I believe the same age that Brady was when he won his first Super Bowl. So it's going to be an interesting sort of young versus old, experience versus new to this whole Super Bowl thing. So I think that's one thing we'll watch. How does Sean McVay, you know, game plan to a duel with Belichick? And how does Jared Goff, being so young, handle the pressure? Is he going to be as cool and collected as Brady was in his first Super Bowl?
Well, it is MLK Day, so I want to ask, what's happening with the controversy over the national anthem in the NFL?
Well, as I understand it, Atlanta is considered the current day hip hop capital. And there was a lot of controversy when the NFL named its headliner Maroon 5 for the halftime act. Many people felt like if you're in Atlanta, you should invite black artists because there's such a part of the cultural scene of that city. Then there was also the complication, or another part of the equation, is the fact that many black artists didn't want to participate in the halftime show because of what's going on with Colin Kaepernick and his anthem protests. However, that being said, One of the highlights will certainly be Gladys Knight performing the national anthem. And she actually talked to Variety about performing the national anthem and what it would mean. And this is what she said. It's unfortunate that our national anthem has been dragged into this debate when the distinctive senses of the national anthem and fighting for justice should each stand alone. I'm here today and on Sunday, February 3rd, to give the anthem back its voice, to stand for that historic choice of words and the way it unites us when we hear it and frees us from the same prejudices and struggles I have fought long and hard for all my life. And I think that's kind of what you hope is it's the show and the people who are representing the city of Atlanta in the entertainment portion of the game have that there's that same sentiment and bring that to the entertainment portion.
And who's the victor? Who wins?
Who wins? I got to go with age and experience on this one.
All right.
I think, you know, it's going to be close. It's going to be a close game, but I do think the Patriots eke it out. And I think actually they learn from their loss last year. I think they kind of, you know, you got that sense when they were in Minnesota, they weren't quite mentally there for that game. There were some lapses and it just didn't seem like a cohesive team on the field. I think they are locked in and focused and leaning into that underdog narrative and ready to go.
Okay, we'll hold you to it.
WBUR
Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, Eve Zukoff, and Walt Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait. Don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.